Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everyone. My name is Theodoros Mavridis. I'm a consultant neurologist and stroke specialist in Tala University Hospital in Dublin, Ireland. And I'm honored today that I have with me Professor David Saifke, who is a professor of clinical neurology at the University of Bern and the head of the stroke unit at the Department of Neurology of the Inselspital University Hospital in Bern, Switzerland. And today we're going to go through a very, very interesting subject, which is breakthrough stroke and diagnostic and therapeutic dilemmas. So with no more waiting, I would like to ask the first question. How would you define what is a breakthrough stroke?
Yeah, thank you, Theodoros, for this nice invitation and introduction. And of course, I think that that's a very interesting topic. So a breakthrough stroke, in general, you would define this as an ischemic stroke happening in a patient who is already taking an antithrombotic therapy, either antiplatelet therapy or oral anticoagulation, because the stroke breaks through the protection the patient was supposed to take to protect the patient from a stroke. In general, there are two types, or we would differentiate between two types, those who break the strokes on antiplatelet therapies, and on the other hand, and those which are, from my perspective, even more interesting and more worrisome, are those patients who have a breakthrough stroke despite being on oral anticoagulation therapy.
Great. Thank you for this initial experience on that. I would like to ask you further, and how would you distinguish a real breakthrough stroke in terms of if a patient, for example, is on anticoagulation and the patient has a breakthrough stroke, what would you investigate further? Is it a true breakthrough stroke? Is it a treatment failure? What would be the mechanisms and what does the evidence say about
it? Yeah, that's a very frequent scenario that we see in our stroke units. We are talking about patients who are already known to have atrial fibrillation, who have already been started on oral anticoagulation by their treating physicians, but they still suffer a stroke. And that's actually a quite important number of patients. We count about half of all atrial fibrillation-related strokes in Switzerland, which sums up to an overall of about 10% of all strokes in Switzerland. And these are comparable numbers in other European countries, for example, like Norway. And what we have to do in those patients is we have to use our brains to think what could be the cause of the stroke, because just the patient has atrial fibrillation doesn't mean that the stroke is actually cardioembolic. So we need to investigate those patients as we would do for any other stroke patients, meaning we would take a personal history to see whether the patient was actually taking the anticoagulation, which he was supposed to take, whether the patient was actually stopped for a few days on anticoagulation because he was undergoing any intervention which requires stopping anticoagulation. So then we actually have a cause of the stroke. There are also some patients who just don't take their medication. So malcompliance or lack of compliance is an issue. But at the end, this turns out to be a minority of all patients. Historically, we thought that there were many of them having strokes because they just stopped anticoagulation, but overall, it's about 10 to 20% of all strokes that we see. In those remaining patients, we actually need to go deeper into actual causes. So we need to investigate the blood vessels, and we need to also investigate other potential causes, meaning we have to see whether for example, the patient has concomitant large artery atherosclerosis with a high-grade stenosis, which may cause a stroke, or small vessel disease, which causes a stroke, or other causes of stroke. So just because the patient was on has atrial fibrillation, mustn't mean the stroke is cardioembolic. And at the end, we will find probably 25% of all AFib patients having other competing non-cardioembolic causes of stroke, which in turn means that the vast majority still has a pure breakthrough stroke of a cardioembolic origin.
Thank you for this insight. It's true that it's better to investigate further when we have a breakthrough stroke to see, again, the compliance and, of course, if there's a competing etiology. let's start with the compliance, then we'll go into competing etiologies, and then we'll finally go to the true breakthrough strokes. In terms of compliance, and let's go for the patients who are, for example, with atrial fibrillation and they need anticoagulation. Nowadays, we mostly use direct oral anticoagulation instead of warfarin or arsenicumarol. But still, how would you assess compliance on those patients? Do you fear that some of the patients are not taking proper medication? And I'm not talking about the patients who tell you that they stop the medication for a surgical procedure, but you're not quite sure if they're taking the medication properly, even though prescribed properly.
Yes, that's a good question. So 10, 15 years ago, assessing compliance of a patient on anticoagulation was much easier because we had only vitamin K antagonists. We could measure the INR and then determine whether the INR was on a therapeutic level or not. But this is unfortunately much more complicated, as you said, nowadays. So these direct oral anticoagulants are actually very, very beneficial drugs, but the limitation is that many centers are not able to or do not have the possibility to measure actually drug-specific anticoagulation activity for those agents, which is possible, which is available. So you can measure anti-10A or calibrated anti-10A activity for the 10A inhibitors or a specific aspirin trotting time for dabigatran, for example, in your central lab, and you get values back. But also interpreting these values is much more complicated because the drug levels highly fluctuating over time, decreasing over time with renal clearance, meaning that you have to interpret the measure, the level that you measure with respect to the dosage of the drug the patient was taking, the time point of last intake, and the time point of blood sampling, which makes it a very, very complicated process. So in our daily practice, what we are doing in my hospital, we are measuring drug-specific anticoagulation activity for DOACs in the emergency department. But rather than looking at the exact level, we are looking at it in a qualitative way, meaning that if there was some activity present, we assume that the patient was at least taking the drug. If there was no activity at all measurable, then actually we have a good argument that the patient was very likely to be non-compliant with the drug. The absolute levels are very, very difficult to interpret. And I think adjusting anticoagulation based on these measurements is also quite complicated, so I would refrain from it.
Yes, this is very, very useful in terms of clinical practice. So we basically, what we do in clinical practice, we basically take the word of the patient. If the patient is taking the medication, then the patient is taking the medication, basically. But yeah, there are other ways to figure out if it was done properly. So the next question is about competing etiologies, which is the most common one, and how would you address that specific etiology? Because we know, for example, in other trials with patients with AFib and had, for example, a stenosed carotid artery, there was no much difference in terms of if we put antiplatelet on top of anticoagulation compared to anticoagulation and so on in a recent trial that was published. But I want to hear your expert thoughts on that.
Yeah. So you already pointed out the most frequent competing non-cardiombolic etiology in patients with atrial fibrillation having a breakthrough stroke is actually large artery atherosclerosis. And in those patients, usually you will find moderate to high-grade stenosis ipsilateral to the stroke. And if this picture turns out, so you actually investigate the patient, you see a high-grade stenosis, and you also see a neuroimaging that the infarct pattern in the brain on MRI or CT corresponds to a unilateral stroke within the territory of the supplying artery, then you can be quite confident that this is actually a atherosclerotic stroke and not an AFib-related stroke. And what we do in our clinical practice is actually we are quite pro-aggressive in suggesting revascularization therapies to those patients, meaning to stent or to perform a carotid endarterectomy for a high or a medium-grade stenosis, if suitable, on top of oral anticoagulation therapy, to be continued afterwards. It is a bit more complicated for patients with an intracranial stenosis, where stenting is usually only a second line choice, or for low-grade atherosclerosis patients who don't qualify actually for a revascularization because the degree of stenosis is not high enough. And then these patients actually don't have real evidence what to do. And as you mentioned, adding antiplatelet therapy on top of anticoagulation, those patients, also seeming a good idea, turned out to be quite not protective for further strokes, at least in observational data, and mostly associated with a higher bleeding risk rather than protecting those patients from stroke. So in general, I would advise not to add antiplatelets to those patients.
Great. Let's go into my favorite and most interesting part, the true breakthrough strokes of those patients. For this specific subgroup of anticoagulated patients who you have done all the investigation, you didn't find any other competing cause, the patient was taking proper medication, they had a really good level of inhibition, and they still have a breakthrough stroke. How would you treat those patients? What more investigation would you do? And what about trials?
Yeah, so that's actually the most frequent subgroup of patients. At the end, the majority of patients actually fall into this category that you just mentioned. So they have a real cardioembolic breakthrough stroke. And it's also a bit disappointing for those patients because actually they did everything right. They took their drug, they took the right drug, and they still had a stroke. So first, it's quite disappointing for patients. What we do in those patients, actually, we start with investigating also the left atrial and the left atrial appendage to investigate the structure and whether there are still remaining thrombus, which actually we did some studies with colleagues together, and in a quarter of those patients you will actually find remaining thrombus in the left atrium, left atrial appendage, which seems like a smoking gun for you, seeing that one part of thrombus already caused a stroke, but there's still some remaining thrombus in the heart, and we actually need to protect those patients from further strokes. These are the patients at the highest risk of having early recurrent strokes, with an annual risk of about 7% in the first year, which is really high for a stroke population. Historically, we actually changed anticoagulation frequently because there are different types of 10A inhibitors, thrombin inhibitors. So we switched from one agent to the other, taking once daily to taking twice daily or the other way around, because we are actually human beings. We would like to do something. As I told you, patients are probably a bit disappointed because something happened, although they took their drug. So we are going to change the drug to have done something which helps the patient, which helps ourselves, our psychology. But at the end, we, at least from observational studies, we found that it doesn't really matter for the patient. The risk of recurrence is the same whether you change the anticoagulant or not. So you can just continue with the same drug as before, as long as it is correctly dosed and frequent and taken in the way it should be taken. So we have to actually investigate new ways to protect those patients from recurrent stroke because, as I said, the risk is high. There are currently several trials ongoing which investigate this topic and from different perspectives. So one potential option would be early rhythm control. So we know that for patients with atrial fibrillation, who the time they are actually in atrial fibrillation, what we would call the burden of atrial fibrillation, is also important for the stroke risk. And the more the patients are actually in a sinus rhythm and the less frequent they are in AFib, the lower the risk of stroke is for those patients. The only downside is that it actually hasn't never been tested in patients with acute stroke. So we don't know whether it's safe to do it in patients with acute stroke. Fortunately, there is now an ongoing trial which is going to start soon. It's called E-Stroke. It's an academic trial from mainly coordinated from Hamburg in Germany, which is going to investigate early rhythm control in patients with atrial fibrillation stroke. So not limited to breakthrough stroke patients, but I think these data are very likely to be also beneficial for patients with breakthrough stroke. So that's the part of rhythm control. Another option would be to actually target the culprit. And as I told you, the left atrial appendage is actually a structure adjacent to left atrium, which harbors the majority of all cardiac thrombi in patients with atrial fibrillation. And we know from patients who cannot take oral anticoagulation that closing the left atrial appendage is beneficial to protect them from stroke. There are two ways to do it. There are surgical ways. You just operate and close the AAA, the left atrial appendage. But there are also, and it's the most frequent way to do it, it's a percutaneous left atrial appendage closure. But this hasn't been tested so far in combination with anticoagulation. We know it from patients who cannot take anticoagulants, so we take it as a substitute for anticoagulation therapy. But what about combining it with oral anticoagulation therapy? Together with colleagues, we did some observational studies, hypothesis generating, to see whether combining oral anticoagulation with left atrial appendage closure in patients with breakthrough stroke is beneficial, and preliminary data suggest that it might be of benefit. And now we are going to test it in a randomized controlled trial because we have to prove it. This trial is called ELAPS. It's also an academic trial funded by the Swiss National Science Foundation. And we started recruiting about 1 year ago in several countries in Europe and outside of Europe to enroll actually patients with a breakthrough stroke to receive left atrial appendage closure on top of oral anticoagulation or oral anticoagulation alone. And we will see whether this treatment turns out to be beneficial. And the third option actually is to protect the brain directly, because the majority of atrial fibrillation related strokes are actually larger thrombi going up the carotid arteries in the anterior circulation. So it might be a good idea to protect the anterior circulation and shield the anterior circulation from these large clots. And there's now a new trial going to start quite soon, which will investigate bilateral carotid filter devices on top of oral anticoagulation in patients with atrial fibrillation and stroke to see whether these filters actually are also beneficial to protect the anterior circulation, which is the culprit here, from further strokes. And it's also going to be tested in a randomized controlled trial, which I think is very beneficial, because at the end, we will have really good data from randomized controlled trial to make treatment decisions.
This is very interesting things that we heard. And I think that, of course, as a take-home message, I will go a bit further on your talk that you said that we shouldn't be changing oral anticoagulation from one to the other. It may be more harmful to change, and there are data that support that. And of course, we need to explore other alternatives. And of course, all those things are very, very interesting. And we're waiting for the results of the randomized trials. The prospective, the observational trials are really promising, but we need the results from the randomized trials. And this is very, very important. Now I will go to something different. I will jump from the anticoagulation breakthrough strokes to the antiplatelet breakthrough strokes. So we see patients who get recurrent strokes instead of putting antiplatelet therapy. We know that the number needed to treat is not really impressive, even though aspirin is the main choice or clopidogrel, and nothing seems to beat it so far. We have the new drugs that are coming from the randomized trials, specifically the anti-11 drugs. And I want your thoughts on breakthrough strokes in patients who are under antiplatelet therapy.
Yeah, that's also actually a quite even larger patient population. So we recently did an analysis from our National Swiss Stroke Registry, which actually covers all strokes happening in Switzerland. And actually, more than 30% of all stroke patients were already on aspirin at the time point of stroke for any reason. Might be that they have had a previous stroke, might be they have coronary artery disease or peripheral artery disease or other conditions that require antiplatelet therapy. But a significant number of all stroke patients is already on antiplatelet therapy. And as you said, our current paradigm is we may probably put them on a dual antiplatelet therapy for short term, but or for short or long, they will finish up being again on antiplatelet therapy, single antiplatelet therapy. And that's also very, it's not very satisfying. We also know from literature that those patients tend to have also higher risk of stroke. So usually what we should do in those patients is, of course, looking for other etiologies that warrant therapy change, probably look for atrial fibrillation, which then requires anticoagulation, or look for a high-grade stenosis, which requires thrombid arteriectomy or stenting. But at the end, the majority of those patients will not have these conditions, and we are forced to still continue with antiplatelet therapy. You elucidated to several currently ongoing trials, which are investigating a very interesting approach, meaning that to combine antiplatelet therapy with another very specific agent to inhibit factor 11, which is a very specific factor in the coagulation cascade. So we're not very sure whether they should call it anticoagulants or just factor 11 inhibitors. I think factor 11 inhibitors may be the best way to describe it because it's very precise. And we know that they seem to be very safe, so they seem not to increase the risk of bleeding, but they might add an additional protection for stroke to those patients. And there are two trials. One is called Oceanic. The other one is called Librexia, which are currently ongoing. And some of them will likely have results within the next few months, which are really exciting because they might fundamentally change our way to treat those patients. If proven positive, then we will have a new tool in our toolbox to treat those patients. And I think those patients who already had a stroke despite being on antiplatelet therapy would be the first for me to put on this new drugs, because I think then we have really something to offer to those patients. But at the moment, we unfortunately have to speculate about the results because the trials haven't been finished, so we don't actually know whether or not they are beneficial.
I would like to thank you for all your interesting thoughts and all your expertise that you provided to us about this very intriguing topic, which is breakthrough strokes. And we're hoping that we'll see more in the near future from the randomized controlled trials, and we'll have more things to discuss the next time. Thank you, Professor Saifke. Thank you very much for this interesting talk.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mavridis, and thank you very much, EAN, for this opportunity.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.